This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Let's play some Take-A-Mania. Love this game. Going to throw it here to you, Seth, to set these up, man. And yes. I am going. And I enjoy judging other people's takes as somebody who has now over the years become a take artist himself, so to speak. I am all the way here for this. So let's get it going. So Take-A-Mania right here on Payne and Pendergast.
These are some of the worst takes we've heard in the last week from around our this great country of ours. The current champion is Andrew Perloff, and this was his opinion on Steph Curry's hamstring injury not being that big of a deal.
You guys don't think that Curry has any chance to come back from this? I mean, we've all had little hamstring pulls. They're
the
tough.
Amount that he runs and how right. he has to move throughout a game, I don't
What are you talking about? He goes from the top of the three-point line on one side to the top of the three-point line on the other.
Constantly moving.
That cannot be further from
moving on offense is easy. Moving on, I mean, they'll hide him on defense. All he has to do is hit a bunch of threes.
Ask Reggie Miller and Klay Thompson, guys who do that stuff, the kind of, and Ray Allen, the kind of conditioning they do. It's grueling. It's like, that is very hard. It's terribly hard on the defenders to cover those guys because they're in better shape than them.
As a former big man in high school, I'll tell you right now, the guards don't do crap. They're running 40 yards.
Give me a break.
And Steph, running on offense doesn't count.
He was like the most well-conditioned guy in the NBA because of all the stuff he did off the ball. Like,
oh, he's a goalie.
This could not be more wrong.
Well, regardless, though, I mean, I think like he can be effective in a different way.
Regardless if I'm wrong.
Like, he's a hamstring injury. If it's John Morant and he has an injury, as we saw, that's bad. But Steph can be effective a little bit, right? Like, you still have to watch out for Steph. I don't care if he has one functional leg.
Yeah, he just kept digging deeper and deeper and deeper.
This is so bad.
It's so bad, and we're going to have to get – Sean and I decided last week we're going to have a time limit on how long you can be the current title holder, and then he'll be entered in the tournament at the end of the year. This might be the last week. We might have to rotate him out after this week to clear some way, although we do have a couple strong contenders this week.
Oh, man. He has earned his place, though, because as they are tearing down his take, as they are tearing down his argument – he just continues to double down with, you know, regardless. Like when somebody just eviscerates a thing that you say. No, it's not regardless if we have shut down the premise of which what we're talking about.
I blame then it's not social
media. We have to start over now. It's not regardless. Let's start over.
I blame social media because this is what you see all the time. Like some politician will say something that has like four factually incorrect things in it. And somebody will point out, hey, these four things were factually incorrect. The next reply is almost always, regardless, the basic gist of what he was saying was true. Like, yeah. All right, fine.
Yeah. Never mind the false premise in which this is built off of. Let's just keep going. I do want to say that this reminds me of Boomer Esiason coined a term that I heard. I heard him on one of our Odyssey stations a couple years ago, and he coined a term that I think is perfect for this, and I think you can appreciate this as a former player, Seth. He called it NARPian. He says, these are NARPian takes. He's made an acronym. He's calling us, and I'll put myself in this category, he's calling us NARPs. N-A-R-P, it stands for non-athletic regular people. A take that a non-athletic regular person might have is like, well, what is all that running around that Steph does anyway? Is it really all that hard? All he's got to do is just run to the free throw line and shoot the ball.
I object to him doing that. I always try to be really careful to say, well, you don't know because you didn't play the game. Because like your job is to explain what it's like to play the game.
Yeah.
So yes, whenever an ex-athlete complains about like, oh, you don't understand because you didn't play the game. Like, all right, you're abdicating your responsibility. The only reason I have a job is because I played football. So like, let me try to explain what it is like to play the game, and that's where our differences might lie.
Yeah, but he's doing that all in good fun on Boomer Esiason's part.
Yeah.
But when it comes to Andrew Perloff, this is definitely the take of somebody that ain't did no running around.
Right.
You know what I mean? Not even just you didn't play. This isn't a you didn't play professional ball take. This is a maybe you don't exercise. Maybe you don't even. Maybe you don't even play pickup ball.
No, that's a really good point. It was a window into probably the frustration his high school head coach had with him. It was like, yeah, there was a reason you weren't a guard, you lazy SOB, because you just wanted to stand around and all right. So, I tried to seed these. I don't think this one's going to knock off Andrew Perloff, but this is Peter King telling a story about one of Jerry Jones's worst takes ever.
Stephen Jones gets on the phone, calls 19 different teams, trying to move up to get Paxton Lynch later in the first round. And so Jerry is pacing. He's going back and forth. Come on, we got to do it. And he wanted to sweeten the pot. And everybody else in the room is thinking, geez, Jerry, he's not that good. The next day, Jerry says to me, you know, I've overpaid for everything that's great in my life. And we should have overpaid and moved up and gotten Paxton Lynch. He was angry, really angry. And so just goes to show you, sometimes the best deals are the ones you don't make.
Yeah, that was a bad take by Jerry Jones at the time. Mostly yes. I just wanted to play that to torment Cowboys fans. You got to remember, this is going on every single draft. Whether it's Johnny Manziel or anybody else, the people who know football in the room are arguing with their boss, or I'm guessing pretending to make phone calls. I'm guessing there was a little bit of, with Jerry Jones, what percentage of phone calls made in the war room are actually fake phone calls?
Ooh.
Of Steven claiming he's on the line with somebody saying, yeah, dad, boy, oh, we're close. We're close, dad. Wait a second. Oh, they turned us down, dad. I offered him 4 first round picks and they turned us down.
I mean, he's running the show there. I know his kids are kind of helping or have been helping for quite some time now, but I figure over the years now, the number on that has got to be limitless at this point. I'm going to tell you my favorite part about that, what we just played. And we'll play it again just for a second here. When Peter King says Paxton Lynch with such disgust, that made this for me. This part made this take for me.
Stephen Jones gets on the phone, calls 19 different teams trying to move up to get Paxton Lynch.
Paxton Lynch, like the how offended Peter King is by the notion is just great to me.
I think in fairness to Paxton Lynch and Jerry Jones, he did go in the first round.
He did.
It's, you know, to John Elway, whatever you want to say, John Elway, he's been an architect of a Super Bowl team more recently than Jerry Jones.
He lasted on that team for 2 seasons.
Yeah.
the first round quarterback.
So, Ben. Seasons. Ben, no, this will not beat Perloff. All right, so this next one, Jay Williams was on with Stephen A. Smith. And Jay Williams was making some really good points about, I think he was making some good points about, you know, players these days, young basketball players, not wanting to be coached hard because it's all about, you know, NIL and all of this other stuff, that it's hard to coach guys. They're having a discussion about why there have been so few American-born MVPs and that, you know, like part of it is that maybe they just feel like guys don't get coached as well. I felt like he took it a step too far at the very end here.
I got to ask you this real quick, just because I know you focus on this and people aren't going to like it, but I really don't care. So, how much of this do you think is cancel culture and the political aspects of where we were compared to where we're going? Can we get back to a little bit more, this is what it takes, or be a little bit more in your face direct instead of I'm worried about how I, because I hear a lot of coaches talk about they don't feel like they can coach young kids anymore because anything that they say could get used against them or get twisted if caught the wrong way.
I guess that's the part of me that the issue I have with that is that a lot of the cancel culture when it comes to sports has been like really nasty stuff that coaches have done. I get this image of all these coaches are out there like, I just want to clock the kid every now and then.
I just want to lock him in a room.
Why can I not grab one of my female players by the ponytail? Yeah. Well, everybody's gotten too sensitive. So I feel like taking it to cancel culture was a little too far.
That chair is just sitting there. Why I can't throw it at him? You know,
like most coaches aren't getting fired because they benched a kid or something. Now, if they do get fired because of that, I think a lot of it goes back to the old school dynamics that have been around forever where like, oh, you bench the athletic director's kid. Yeah, you're going to lose your job or whatever. It's not fair or right, but I don't think it's quite cancel culture. But he does not beat Andrew Perloff.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. It is pretty bad. But, like, again, I don't think cancel culture equates to you can't coach players hard. You can't coach players. Like, it just equates to abuse is no longer accepted or turned a blind eye to. That can cost you your job. It can cost you public humiliation. That's what the implication of cancel culture is. Like, it's just much more humiliating to be a jerk, to be an a-hole. But it is not necessarily cancel culture that's going to keep you from coaching players hard. That's kind of ridiculous.
All right, Nick Wright. Now, this one was done kind of tongue-in-cheek, but let's analyze it like it's 100% serious. So, yeah, Nick Wright is tired of NBA players demanding reviews on calls, and you do the little finger circle in the air to show that let's rewind it. He's tired of seeing players do that all the time. So this is Nick's idea for how you remedy that.
New rule for the NBA next season.
Take of the year.
Thank you, Wild.
Take of the year.
This is binding.
Yes.
This is binding. And guess what? It'll be fixed within a week. The moment any player on the court does this, all right, challenge accepted. And by the way, if you're out of challenges, it's just like when you're out of timeouts and you call one, that's a Chris Webber. That's a technical foul. Guys, you're right. You can call timeout. You can call for a challenge. You wave your finger around in the air. The refs say challenge.
There was a stretch where it was.
There was maddening. A stretch.
I'm tired of it myself.
Thank you.
I don't think you need to go
All right, let's pretend that was a serious take.
Drastic 100%. Times call for drastic measures, man.
I actually think it's a good take. There's some gestures that have been banned for sexual reasons you can't do the gun or anything like that. That makes sense, but there's far more gestures that I would have banned just because they annoy me. I've grown tired of the first down after anything other than a spectacular first down. When a player gets up and does both fingers, the Texans do it with a lot of flair and I appreciate it, but I'm just kind of tired of it.
Yeah.
The eating, the two spoons eating, I hate that motion. I cannot stand it.
Now you're just against celebrate. Like, so this that Nick is railing against is, it's like distracting and shows up both the refs and the coaches, I think. But you're now anti-celebration?
Not anti-celebration. Anti-imitation celebration.
Okay,
I think you should only be. Same way with like the barbed wire tattoo around the arm. I think the first person that ever got that tattoo, it was badass. But then when 50% of 1999 frat boys had it, it lost a little bit of its edge, you know?
That's fair.
So at some point, like the first, you can be first in, last out, but nothing in between.
Yes,
so
fair enough.
Nick, but all being said, it was tongue-in-cheek, so Nick Wright
But you know what? It was tongue-in-cheek, but Richard Jefferson actually repeated it on the ESPN broadcast. Like, he brought it
like
to
in a more serious tone?
He brought it to the mainstream and said he agreed with it 100% because obviously, of course, it happened again since Nick Wright said it. So, yeah, I don't think that there's actual legs behind this, but there are people, not just you, not just Nick Wright, not just myself, enough of us are annoyed with the twirling of the finger for somebody to review a play.
Okay, so Nick Wright does not. There we go. Two strong contenders here. Let's roll with Kendrick Perkins saying that that Anthony Edwards cannot be the face of the league for one very specific reason.
It's the bigger picture, right? You got to check the boxes when you're the face of the league. Yes, we know you got to have your signature shoe. You're going to be in commercials. You're going to have the highlights. You got to have the game. But you know what else you got to have? You got to be a role model, right? And things outside the lines matter. Now, if you go down the list of all the faces of the league in the history of the game, you look at Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, Shaq, LeBron, Steph, what did they all have in common? While they was playing in the league, they all were family men. They all were married with kids. And if you think that don't play a role as far as the role model, this is facts. This is not something that This is not something that I'm making up. Now, what happened to them after they retired? That's their business. But while they are playing or was playing, they were family men, married with kids.
Well, As soon as he said Kobe, I was waiting for him to say Tiger as the face of the PGA. Yeah. Because on the virtue of them being such strong family men. Or Larry Bird. Larry Bird, who wasn't married for the first 10 years of his NBA career and also had a tumultuous personal life. Like, almost every single one of those guys were, yes, on the surface level, they checked off the box of having a wife at some point and having kids. But it wasn't like they were the prime example of, yeah, this is how you should conduct your personal life.
Yeah, when I got married, the first thing that I said was, I want to be like Mike. I want to be like Michael Jordan. Where I'm a philanderer and I gamble more than I probably spend time with my wife. Like, I want to be the Michael Jordan of husbands. That's exactly. This is awful. This is so bad. And there's a lot of side commentary that could be had about Ant Edwards and some of his personal life.
Right.
But this is too much.
That whole list that he pointed out was basically, no, the criterion is, are you an extraordinarily great player? That's all it is.
Yep.
It has nothing to do with whether they were not married, whether they acted like they were married or anything else like that. Oh,
that was rough. And Kobe, by the way, I mean, rest in peace, but infamously married with kids.
He was the face of one of the faces of the league.
Yeah,
at least. Yeah.
Infamously married, and you know we know how 2003, whatever year it was in Colorado, how that panned out. That was rough.
Yeah.
Rough to hear.
I'm having a hard time with this one. I can't for one more week. I can't knock off Perloff. I can't do it. So Perloff remains the champion after strong contention by Kendrick Perkins. We're going to keep him eligible for the end of the year tournament. He might have to play in a qualifying round, but that's a pretty bad take.
Yeah, so. a pretty bad take. A segment full of bad takes, and that is Take-A-Mania. But coming up next, I feel like I've got a pretty good take, and that is that Jose Altuve's move from second base to left field, so far, it's been a resounding success. I'll explain that next.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Jose Altuve's move from second base to left field this season has already been a resounding success. And I already see it on the text line going into this segment. We get it from the 979. I'm going to go ahead and say it. Altuve is a horrible left fielder. Yes, he's done a better job than expected, but he still sucks as a fielder. He is not a good left fielder, okay? So that is the first piece of feedback that we get on this take that I have, that Jose Altuve's move from second base to left field has already been a resounding success. But go ahead, Seth. Go ahead.
Well, no, this is the thing, though. He has had some moments. He's had moments, especially recently, where he looks like a guy that's still feeling his way out in left field, especially off the carom. The carom off the wall, it got him a couple of times the other night. Sometimes his inability to time his jump is comical at times. So some of the mistakes that he's made.
Because he's not an outfielder. He's not an outfielder. He's learning.
Right. No. You can make excuses for him, but it still doesn't look like exactly what you want to see out of a left field. The difference is that he's also made up for some of those things with his range at times. He also benefits from having a really good center fielder playing next to him. He's not been a drain on the defense or anything, though. He's had some comical errors or miscues, but by and large, this is going better than I thought it might, or that I feared that it would.
So I don't like to be the guy that steps into a conversation and then tries to tell people that they're having the wrong conversation. I feel like that can be really annoying and very like off-putting and patronizing, right? Like when you're like, oh, well, you know, this conversation that you guys are having is stupid. You should really be having this conversation. Like you're like you're the better conversationalist and point maker. Like, I don't like to do that, but this is motivated a little bit by observing the conversation about Jose Altuve in left field and feeling like it sort of misses the plot or doesn't quite see the forest for the trees or forgets exactly what this move was actually about. And I don't feel like we should lose sight of this whenever we're talking about him or evaluating him out in left field. Yes, I think we can all agree that Jose Altuve in left field is odd. It's strange. It doesn't look natural. He's not a natural. He's not great at it, even if he has been better at it than we expected. It is less than ideal watching him out there in left field. But I think it's important to remember that they didn't put Jose Altuve out in left field because they felt so great about Jose Altuve's potential at 35 years old, his potential to like blossom and evolve into some kind of outfielder all of a sudden. Like mm-hmm. That wasn't the logic. That wasn't the reason. That wasn't the motivation behind making that move. It had nothing, really nothing to do with how well Jose Altuve could play left field. It was more about, can he play left field at all? Because we need to hide him somewhere. Jose Altuve's move to left field was less about him playing left field and more so about him no longer playing second base. What they were trying to do was upgrade their production, their defensive production at second base, because over the last couple of years, it had plummeted to be about close to some of the worst that you could see, that you could find all across baseball. Jose Altuve was one of the worst fielding second basemen in all of baseball last year, and it wasn't that much better the year before that. It wasn't catastrophic the year before that.
The elimination of the shift is where it really started exposing, yes. Oh man, he's lost a step. He's not quite the same guy. So it's not like, it's not an either or that, oh, I can't believe they moved Altuve to left field because now he's not good for them defensively out there. He wasn't good for you defensively at second base right. The last couple of years.
Right.
And as far as, I just want to know, like, if you're stumping for this somehow being a huge disaster or something, he's still this year better in the outfield than Kyle Tucker is. Like, Kyle Tucker, it would drive me insane the last couple of years when people would insist that Kyle Tucker was still playing really well in the outfield, because he wasn't. He wasn't the same guy that he had been 3 years ago when he was a gold glove type guy in right field. And a lot of it was just him kind of lazing around in the outfield. So unless you were clamoring for Kyle Tucker to be removed from right field last year, I can't really get on board with saying that Altuve being in left field is somehow one of the things that's crushing this team right now.
Well, Kyle Tucker is his own conversation, because that part is interesting, how you could go from being as great as he was in the outfield to being so bad. Like, I don't know if I've ever seen, and I know he ended up getting injured and having the whole shin thing, but I don't feel like the downgrading of his defense had much to do with injury as much as it was like really hard to explain. I'm not really sure why he's not as good of an outfielder as he had been before. But specifically with Altuve, though, this is why I say it is a resounding success. And I had to preface it with, they did this to upgrade what they were doing at second base, and we understand that they're doing a committee thing at second base. But look at the change in production at second base. That's what, defensively I'm talking about, that's what makes this a resounding success, at least so far. We're only a third of the way through the season, and time will tell if it's ultimately a success in the long run. But up to this point, okay, the Astros last season among second basemen, okay, they were fourth to last. Only three teams in all of baseball, really only two teams in all of baseball had a worse outs above average at second base than the Astros did in 2024, okay? That's just last season with Jose Altuve playing the bulk of second base. Would you like the update? Would you like to know what that looks like now for the Astros a third of the way through the 2025 season? The Astros, lo and behold, are the best team in baseball in outs above average at second base. Addition by subtraction, taking Jose Altuve and hiding him out there in left field in a space where, hey, it's not ideal, but can we hide him out there? Can the downgrade in left field that we get by putting Jose Altuve, who's not a natural outfielder, out there be negligible or like a better downgrade than the one that we have at second base right now with him playing it? Or can we get a much better upgrade at second base that makes up the difference for the downgrade that we get at left field where we're hiding Jose Altuve? The answer to that so far, a third of the way through the season, is 100% yes. You know, that's the answer.
The part that's frustrating about that is that a lot of that run value, the five runs saved, comes from Mauricio Dubon to Brendan Rodgers having one run saved despite having like many more opportunities. Like, yeah. Dubon, I want Dubon to be the second baseman. It's like Brendan Rodgers, when he's not playing in Colorado, is just not the guy that I want or need to see on this team. With Altuve, the fact that now I think people are going to be less focused on anything in left field as long as he continues to hit the way he's been hitting since they came home. That's a huge part of it. It's a lot easier to excuse any flubs in left field. So he's minus one run value in left field. Kyle Tucker this year is minus two run value in right field. That's where I get the stats from as far as him kind of performing at the same level as Kyle Tucker. As long as he continues to rake and look like classic Jose Altuve, people aren't going to worry about the left field stuff.
Yeah, I mean, literally the text message that we get here in 713-572-4610 is the text line to get involved with the show. Mo Karam, Injury Lawyers, YouTube, and Twitch streams. You can chat in there as well. But I get this text message from the 832. Is it affecting his ability to hit? I've seen that theory out there. He's been raking at home lately, and as far as affecting his ability to hit, you tell me if you've heard different, Seth. But for me, I've always understood it that, like, players who are affected, whose hitting is affected by their defense, it's not necessarily where they play defensively. It's that they play defensively. Like, it's the whole DH-ing thing, right? Jordan Alvarez would talk about this, how he liked playing out in left field because there was something about the groove of it that helped him as a hitter. Now, I don't think the numbers actually bear that out, but players feel that way. It's not, hey, I got to play this position and it's going to affect my ability to hit. It's just that I need to play defense and hit, like not just be a DH. So it's not like they moved Jose Altuve to DH per se.
I could see there being a difference, though, in however it gets you into a groove. If you're in the infield, they're obviously watching, especially at second base. You know, you're watching from a real good perspective. You're thinking about things. You're just fine-tuned with your reaction time more so than you have to be in the outfield. So I could see that being a thing. But it also is just like as it was with Craig Biggio. At some point, you got to acknowledge, all right, it might be the ideal thing for the team is not for Jose Altuve to be a bad second baseman, but as long as he's comfortable at the plate, the ideal thing is for him to figure out how to handle all that part of the challenge and be out in left field and then still be a good hitter. So it's a challenge, yes, but like he was a liability at second base.
Yeah.
He's not nearly the liability in left field that he had become at second base.
That's exactly right. And that's why it's a success. Like, and you're thinking about Jose Altuve, a three-time batting champion. You would like to think, even if he's not going to be a batting champion again, a dude like Jose Altuve that's been hitting as long as he has, you'd like to figure that his chances, or you'd be in favor of his chances of still being able to hit regardless of where he's playing in the field, if he's playing in the field, versus, hey, now he's in his mid-30s and he doesn't play as good of a second base. And you can't afford, like, which risk are you willing to take? That he's kind of got to figure it out at the plate while he's, you know, in left field or DHing or sometimes playing at second base? Or having some of the worst second base defensive play in all of baseball. Like that is the risk that I don't feel like you're willing to take. You're much more willing to take the risk of maybe he's got to figure it out at the plate and get into a different groove. So to me, there's no other way to look at it than Jose Altuve, despite not being an ideal left fielder, that move from second base to left field so far, a third of the way through the season, has been a resounding success. He's Seth Payne. I am Brandon Scott in for Sean Pendergast. And since we're on the subject of defense anyway, let's bring this back. Where can this Texans defense improve? We're also going to bring the guys in from In the Loop for a little bit of crosstalk. That's next on Sports Radio 610.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. you'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I don't want to make too many assumptions here, and I feel like I'm already doing the thing because the Texans defense was good last year, and I expect it to be just as good, if not better, this year, especially considering so many of the important players on the defense are as young as they are and have so much room for growth and improvement. I feel like, Seth, I'm just kind of taking for granted that this defense is going to be awesome. They're going to take this next step. And, hey, let's roll. Let's see if the offense can match that same energy, can keep that same energy and intensity match that the defense brings to the table for the Texans. But I want to kind of caution not just myself but everybody to just, you know, think about and consider some of the ways in which this defense that we really think is going to be really good can still improve. And you've done a really good job of pointing some of these things out throughout the offseason. I feel like now is just as good of a time as any as they take the field. They just took the field about 15 minutes ago for their third OTA practice. Assembled media should be there. So, you know, keep a hold of your timelines or stay locked into your timelines to see what kind of updates you get from that. But to this point, I feel like this Texans defense, as good as it's going to be, is one that still has plenty of room for improvement.
Yeah, don't allow as many points as you did last year. It's as simple as that. And as soon as I say that, people immediately say, well, they weren't getting any help from the offense. No, they were awesome. The Texans defense was awesome at making big plays. They were amongst the league leaders in tackles for a loss, in sacks, in interceptions, all of that. They do a lot of really good opportunistic things. But one of the areas in which they were the league worst was in the deep strikes, the deep touchdowns, the big plays. They just weren't as good in that level. So they'll play really, really well 95% of the time, 19 snaps in a row, and then all of a sudden, boom, they allow a big play. We saw it in the Lions game, for instance. That's the simplest way to put it, is that they can just limit some of those big plays. The question is, all right, if you're an aggressive defense that is making plays behind the line of scrimmage, it's coming up and attacking, how much of that just goes hand in hand with sometimes screwing up and allowing the big plays? And it's not as much about scheme, because the Texans don't really blitz a whole bunch. They're about average in that regard. It's more about the individual players understanding when to be aggressive, when to lay off a little bit, and then also just simply tackling better, which is an improvable skill. It's not just you're not who you are as a tackler when you're 19 years old. You can work at that, and some teams are better at it than others. And the Texans were a bad tackling team last year.
Yeah, so let's go to tackling real quick, and I want to ask you about Kalen Bullock specifically in just a moment. But since you mentioned tackling, I'm always curious about this, and you've talked some about this already this offseason, but I just think it bears repeating. You got paid for a long time to tackle people. Like, how do you actually improve that type of thing when you're not allowed to go to the ground? You only have a certain amount of time where you're allowed to practice, and you don't get as many real live reps. Like, I just imagine the difference between what I'm watching right now to what you guys actually do on a weekly basis out there, just being so markedly different. It's hard to wrap my mind around how you actually really practice that.
There's so many different types of drills that you can do. And you think about rugby players. They don't ever have pads on, and they have drills for tackling. And, you know, they're not taking guys to the ground with full force or anything. It's really just a matter of drilling it and teaching it properly. And because in football, for the most part, there's no full contact scrimmaging in college or the NFL, hardly at all anymore. And it's been that way for a long, long time. Ronnie Lott, this is one of my favorite things when I ever dug deep in Ronnie Lott. Ronnie Lott was a very good tackler, and people love to say, well, he wouldn't make it in today's league because it's too soft. You go back and watch Ronnie Lott highlights, and the vast majority of his big hits were also clean and legal hits by today's standard, because he was starting with a form tackle first. And if he was in position to make a big hit, he'd make the big hit. But he wasn't a guy that was going for the big hit or nothing at all. Like, he still used really good fundamentals. So he practiced on a heavy bag every day, like a huge, gigantic heavy bag for tackling. He did drills and he worked at it. And when you look at it, whenever people use the excuse of, well, what can you really do because you can't practice in pads hardly at all right, that's great. But there's teams that had half as many missed tackles as you did who are following the same rules. It's not like the teams that tackle well are out there doing full-on tackle drills. They're following the same rules you are, and they're doing a better job of it. So it's counterintuitive sometimes. People think that, yeah, there's nothing you can really do about it. No, there are. But the problem is it's taught so poorly, and it's across the board at all levels of football. There are a lot of coaches in the NFL that don't realize how much of a coachable trait it is.
Yeah.
And I just know this from personal experience, because I had one coach teach me how to tackle my fifth year in the NFL, and it changed everything for me.
Yeah, and it's the reason why I framed the question as, what do you do, as opposed to just like blanket statement saying, hey, Seth, there's nothing you can do about it. Because first of all, I don't know that. Second of all, I feel like you wouldn't, if that is true, you would know it better than I. But also the point that you made about, hey, it's not like you're just playing against yourself, right? You're playing against other teams who have figured out a way to do this. Why aren't you one of them? Why are you on the other side or on the wrong side of this ledger? I think, you know, bear some analysis and some breakdown. So I'm 100% here for better tackling. I think that, I think that's something that they absolutely got to key in on. And you figured that OTAs, even when you're not able to go to the ground, it's got to be a key part when they're, you know, drilling some of those fundamentals and doing some of those drills that you're talking about.
Let me tell you another thing. Flag football. I'm going to go to the exact opposite of this end of the spectrum. Listen, media pool. I don't want to hear any more questions. Actually, I do. But I don't want to hear any more questions about guys playing flag football in the Olympics in 3 years or so. Here's Nico Collins. He of the infamously tender hamstrings asked whether or not he's interested in playing in the flag football Olympics.
Yeah, for sure. Get a gold medal. You know, who don't want a gold medal? You know, it's awesome. But nah, it's a blessing. You know, it's something I will, you know, I want to be a part of, you know. But if it happens, it happens. It don't. You know, but it's a goal, you know. Be fun.
It will not happen. I do not need Nico Collins out there 2 weeks before, actually not even, the Olympics go right up until the start of training camp in 2028, whenever it is. No, Nico Collins is not allowed to participate in flag football in the Olympics. It'd be one thing if he had a bunch of injuries where maybe he had a broken bone or something. But like, you know, you have had a lot of soft tissue injuries. I don't need you out there running around full speed competing for your nation right before the NFL season begins.
It is so clear and obvious and transparent. And this is a little inside baseball on my part. It's like a media pro and knows how these things work behind the scenes. It has been so obvious and transparent over the last several days as teams report to OTAs that media members have been assigned the flag football Olympic story. And to go ask people about this at media availabilities, because you heard Nico Collins talking about it just now. D'Amico Ryans was asked about it as well and seemed to want no parts of the question and just could not be less interested in the topic. I saw Patrick Mahomes was asked about it, had a quote about, hey, I'll just leave that kind of thing to the young guys. This, to me, as far as this program is concerned, feels like the World Baseball Classic on steroids. The way you guys hated the idea of Astros out there in the World Baseball Classic. And by the way, Jose Altuve broke his hand, I want to say, in the World Baseball Classic.
Yes,
I'm pretty sure
did.
That happened.
That's exactly what happened.
And right before that play, by the way, I want to say it was, man, I forget what pitcher it was, but it was somebody who might have even been on the Astros who almost decapitated him in the World Baseball Classic right before he broke his hand. But anyway, I feel like this flag football thing is going to be some kind of equivalent to that. Like, keep our players away from this, whether it's cool or not, whether it's fun or not in its own vacuum. I don't care. Keep my local players out of it. That's what it feels like is going to be the energy here.
It's easy enough in baseball to say, like, all right, well, they're just going out and playing baseball. And yeah, injuries happen, but it's not nearly as big a deal as it is in the NFL. But in the NFL, injuries are a week-to-week thing. And you just, we're already playing too many games. By 2028, they might have 18 games on the schedule. That part of it especially is there were so few teams last year that had a huge chunk. Most teams had 5 or 6 players who played all the games. I think on average it was 5 players per team that played all the games in a 17-game season. Some of that's skewed a little bit by a meaningless last game of the year, but there's no part of me that wants that. As we enter the toss here, I've got a little game that I want to play with John Lopez and with Reginald Adetula. Sorry, is your microphone okay?
Yeah, I definitely just broke it in mid-conversation, but it's okay. I can all hold right. it.
Don't worry, I broke it a few times. It's all good this week.
We're going to make it work.
Reginald and John, I'm going to play some audio from the TV series Fargo.
Okay.
And I want to tell you, this is going to be Ted Danson talking to another character in season 2 of Fargo.
Okay.
And I want you to guess who the actor is. So,
I'll
wait until Brandon's got an issue going on.
No, it's all good. I can improvise, man.
All right. This is a police officer, Ted Danson, speaking to this character. I want you to identify who the character is played by.
Now, if I were to search you three, would I find weapons?
Sir, you have nothing to fear from us. We're just passing through town on our way to Point South. Thought we'd stop for some waffles. Gail's idea. Heard you had some real good ones around here. So you can imagine our surprise when we find the place closed and apparently the scene of a crime.
Oh, my goodness.
It's crazy because...
very familiar, but I can't place it.
Right off jump, I had an idea, and then as it continued to go, there was just more and more names that kept throwing it. And you know what's funny? I lost that name because at some point I was like, he does kind of sound a little bit like J.J. Watt as well, and then I just completely lost my
train of thought. You're definitely in a different zone.
No, I'm in a very weird zone.
If I told you it was Dave Chappelle, would it make sense?
Yeah, actually.
Okay. All right, good. I've been released from, like, look, I can be visually racist, but I was worried that I was going to be audibly racist as well. That's Bokeem Woodbine, who for the first 3 episodes of this season, I'm like, is that Dave Chappelle? Is it kind of looks
visual,
like him?
The visual element is going to get you in trouble here. But just off of the voice alone, because, like, Dave can manipulate his voice a little bit. He does have a distinct one, but I imagine if he was in Fargo, he would manipulate it to a place where it would sound kind of like that.
Bokeem Woodbine, it's the pace, and when you watch it over and over again, it's almost like it's Dave Chappelle doing a character on the Chappelle Show. Like, he's really funny just by how dismissive he is at times and everything. So Bokeem Woodbine, no, he looks more like Dave Chappelle than he used to. Yeah. I'm going to send you a picture.
Season 2?
Yeah.
Fargo season 2. I'm like, man, I think Chappelle, did he bulk up?
Yeah, Dave Chappelle's bigger now.
He is bigger.
Yeah.
So
I know he bulked up, but even for this role, he would have bulked up a little bit and had a little bit more facial fat.
This is definitely, though, because Seth and I had this conversation a little bit off air earlier. This is definitely a Two America situation, no doubt. Like, Seth's not being racist, but this is 100% a Two America situation because...
Is Bokeem Woodbine black famous?
Bokeem Woodbine is black famous, and because he's black famous, there is no way that a black person could ever confuse Bokeem Woodbine, not only for Dave Chappelle, but for anybody else.
Besides Bokeem Woodbine.
Besides Bokeem Woodbine.
Because
I would know that it was Bokeem Woodbine.
Correct. Yeah.
Right,
correct.
Right,
he is already individually famous in his own thing within the black community.
Oh.
Jason's Lyric fame. I want to say he was in that. He was in that the Wu-Tang show that they had. He was one of the. He was like the stepfather to RZA in that show.
You know what's
so
sad?
Like he's been around for a while.
You know what's sad, Seth? I was a Fargo addict when it was first coming out, and this was my favorite season of Fargo. I had Billy Bob Thornton.
Oh yeah,
and it was my favorite, and I cannot believe I did not remember that.
Yeah,
so that was the first.
I forgot he wasn't in the first season.
No, this is the second season.
Yeah, this is the second.
Yeah,
season.
This the second season had Billy Bob and Bokeem.
No,
Woodbine.
No,
it didn't.
That was the first season.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
As we discuss this, I should mention that Crosstalk is brought to you by D&M Auto Leasing, and the guys from In the Loop are here: Reginald Adetula, John Lopez, and Figgy Fig.
Hey, I am here to say welcome to acting, Bokeem.
glad you
some
finally
people might
made
say,
it.
Hey, he's been around since 1992. Like, nope. Good. Welcome to the club. You're in a story set in Minnesota where you're the only black character on the show. Yep. And now I know who Bokeem Woodbine is. Yes.
Yes. And here I am.
It's either him or Prince. I'm not sure who it is.
Yeah, at the risk of coming across like Bokeem Woodbine's favorite famous character in Django Unchained, I feel like... Thank you. I'm glad you got that one. I feel like I've been trying to like see if I can get to Seth, like how Seth got here. And I did pull up the picture. I did an image search.
Yes.
And they got him in a fro.
Yeah.
And so like that kind of takes away the head shape qualifiers that you get from these two dudes. And I have not seen any of these scenes with like his actual teeth, because I think those can be a little bit distinctive for him. I can maybe see how you get to that place.
This is what I'm telling you. He doesn't look exactly like Dave Chappelle, but it's like if Dave Chappelle was doing a character,
yes,
and they did some makeup on him, the voice and like the cadence and the rhythm of how he's delivering his lines, that's where it sounds like Dave Chappelle. Yeah.
It does seem like Dave Chappelle, if they wanted to, I think both of these guys are talented enough that Dave Chappelle could play Bokeem Woodbine in a movie.
Yes.
Bokeem Woodbine, if he needed to, could play Dave Chappelle in a movie. I don't know if he's as funny, but he could probably have some success in that way. Just imagine what it's like for me, though, being a 36-year-old black man who cannot remember a day in my life where Bokeem Woodbine did not exist or like was not somebody, and then to come in here to do the show with Seth, and he's like, "Is that Dave Chappelle?"
Or like, I did not say is that Dave Chappelle.
I'm being drastic, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but also like be like, "Oh no, it's not Dave Chappelle. It's not necessarily like they look alike, but I'm going to reveal to Seth who Bokeem Woodbine is." And we all learned something today.
I think Bokeem Woodbine looks different than he did when he was in Life and Everything, like in a way that he doesn't look like an older version of himself from 20 years ago.
Yeah, he is not Can't Get Right from Life anymore. That that is fair enough.
But he also looks a lot slimmer in this season of Fargo.
He is slimmer, and Dave Chappelle is bigger now.
Yeah.
And so something is happening with that.
I got to do some white guilt penance on social media this weekend. I'm gonna have to retweet some stuff and virtue signal and everything. Let everybody know I'm actually a good person deep down inside.
Go answer for your sins and the sins of the past of this country, Seth Payne. Spend your weekend doing that. Mull on that for a little while as we hand things over to In the Loop, which by
reparations.
The way, reparations.
Wait, you guys always want, and I know that we got to be quick with it, but you guys always want to get a taste of the question of the day.
Yeah, I got to hear. We got into Bokeem Woodbine, but I do want to hear about the question of the day and what you guys got.
So, I mean, it's been 25 years since the turn of the century, and the all quarter century Astros team was put out by The Athletic. We'll talk about that, but more importantly, who's on your all time favorite Astros
Doesn't
team?
Doesn't have to be great.
Don't have to be, because I feel like it's honestly sometimes more interesting to get to see the guys who were maybe not great that were fan favorites that stuck with people. So that's who's on your all-time favorite Astros?
I would say I got here in 2002, so I'm like, mine'll be this century.
Sure.
I'll go with Royal as well.
Oh, okay. That's a good one. Okay. I mean, that's a good one. Mine's got to have Tony Eusebio on it.
I got Subi on my team. I did a whole roster.
I got to have Tony Eusebio on there. I got to have Derek Bell on there. Look, there weren't a ton of...
You're two for two.
There weren't a ton of black players on the team when I was coming up in the 90s. These were two of them, and they are definitely going to be on my all-time court. Especially if it's my team that you're asking about.
Yeah.
They're going to be on my team.
Yeah.
Sorry,
Bokeem
not sorry.
Woodbine was drafted by the Astros in the 12th round.
There you go. And Can't Get Right is on there, too. Can't Get Right on my all-time Astros team. So I can't wait to see what y'all come up with.
You got
with
two of mine.
And what the In the Loop audience comes up with. 713-572-4610 is definitely the way to weigh in on that. Make sure that y'all do that at 1040.
Shout-outs to D&M Auto Leasing.
100%. Shout-out to D&M Auto Leasing for providing that wonderful crosstalk for us. In the meantime, you should know that you're listening to KIOTAM, KIOTFM HD2, Houston, and Odyssey Sports Station.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.